This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
We're here at Menards Bank Sale, asking shoppers what they're putting in the bag to get 15% off.
Paint. Batteries.
Tools. Toilet paper.
Extension cords. Grocery items.
Hardware for my cabinets.
Snack items. Crackers and some canned good stuff.
Shop vac supplies.
Toothpaste. Cereal. Coffee. Dog treats. I've got a lot of stuff to grab.
The list goes on, but the sale ends January 24th. Hurry in for Menards 15% off bag sale. See store for complete details.
Save big money at Menards.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. We're going to continue on the dog training kick that we've been on for the last couple episodes. I want to say a rock star when it comes to animal training. I have Ken Ramirez with me today. He was the Executive Vice President and Chief Training Officer at Karen Pryor Clicker Training. He has over 50 years of experience in animal training. We're talking about domestic pets, marine mammals, and exotic animals. He has written a couple books, one on animal training, successful animal management through positive reinforcement, and I Have the Trainer, Animal Training Transformation and Trust. He's an innovator in animal cognition research, exploring concepts like mimicry, counting, and problem solving in dogs and other species. He was former president of the International Marine Animal Trainers Association. He's a passionate advocate for animal welfare, promoting humane and science-based training methods for zoos, conservation efforts, service animals, and pet owners. Training across species has worked with a range of animals, including dogs, dolphins, elephants, species in the wild, and captive environments. Ken, welcome. One heck of a bio. I'm very excited to have you here. Like I said, you're kind of like, I'm kind of like having a rock star moment in my mind. Thank you for
finding the time.
I appreciate you making the invitation, and I look forward to chatting with you today.
So Ken, the listeners don't know this, but you just came back from Africa. Could you give us a little bit what you were doing over there?
Yeah, I have been, one of the things that I'm very passionate about is conservation training. And it's not something that most people have heard of. You don't usually think about training animals that are living in the wild to help them survive challenges to their life. And so I have been working since 2009 was the year that we began thinking about this project. But in Zambia, there exists a herd of elephants that migrate every season north to Tanzania. But on their way to Tanzania, they pass through the Democratic Republic of Congo. Poaching of elephants is, of course, illegal throughout the world, but oftentimes certain countries don't have the manpower or the ability to really police those efforts. And so what was happening during the past 30 plus years is that every time these elephants crossed the border out of Zambia into the Democratic Republic of Congo, they were being slaughtered, and approximately 70 to 75 elephants were being killed each year as the animals made their annual migration north. And so but the interesting thing, if you're familiar with the geography, is Zambia sort of surrounds the southeast corner of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And so Zambia has really good poacher protection laws, but the Democratic Republic of Congo does not. And these elephants literally pass through the corner of the Democratic Republic of Congo and re-enter Zambia again 125 miles later. And it's just that 120 plus miles of terrain that is very dangerous for them. And so the question was asked, could we create a new migration route that bypasses the Democratic Republic of Congo? And so that is what we began working on and establishing a possibility of doing and getting the permits for that from 2009 until 2017. In 2017, we were issued permits to do this project, and we had a setback in 2017 when the poachers found out that we were trying to make this happen, and they attacked our group, and five of us, myself included, were seriously injured and hospitalized. And I think their thought was that it was going to derail the project, but it didn't. But we did delay the start of the project until 2018. 2018 was the first year that we actually managed to start the training process and managed to successfully reroute a herd of 374 elephants around the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that year, 2018, was the first year that that herd lost no animals to poaching. We have now, this year was the, we just completed our seventh year of rerouting the elephants. And so we've got seven successful years of the animals moving on a new route toward Tanzania. And our goal is to be completed in 10 years, the idea being that they will have learned to go the new route and we won't need to be there to guide them the new way, that they'll have learned to do it completely on their own. So we're on the tail end of this project and we hope to have it wrapped up in 2027, where 2028 will be the first year that the elephants hopefully will take this new route without any help or guidance from us. That's the short summary of the project. So
that's crazy. So, but there will always be people in Africa, I guess, that will always be on standby watching the herd, making sure they are still going the right route. But
they will be, but it's not an easy it's not an easy thing to continue. We've put a lot of effort and resources into being able to reinforce the animals. What we've done is we've created man-made watering holes along the new route to reinforce them along the way. And at the beginning, we constructed a very large barrier out of trees to keep the animals from going the old route. We've now removed that barrier, and the only thing that's still there are the water holes, but we have to, because of the concerns for the impact of other species, we are only allowed to put the man-made watering holes in a couple of weeks before the migration, and we have to have the water holes removed a couple of weeks after the migration. And so it's a very labor-intensive effort to do this. And so if the year that we are not there, I will actually be there in 2028, but I'll be there just to observe. We won't be actually allowed to do any training. But I'm hopeful that the animals, I really feel comfortable that the animals have already learned the new route, and that they'll be able to go the route without a barrier and without the water holes to guide them. That's the hope.
Wow. Wow. Unbelievable. I mean, elephants are just amazing, amazing creatures. And they're so smart. I'm pretty sure, well, the younger ones will just know the route, correct, as they age? It's the older ones.
As right. They age?
The younger the animals, ones. The young.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long distance relationship, becoming a first step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay, no insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
The younger animals that have been born into the herd since 2018, they don't know any other route. This new route is the route that they know. The big issue with elephants is they do follow a matriarchal system. And realistically, at first I was overwhelmed with the challenge of training 374 elephants all at the same time. But the reality was what we needed to focus on was the matriarch. And if the matriarch went the way we wanted her to go, it was very likely that all of the other elephants would follow right behind her. And sure enough, they did. So it was not as complex as it could have been if we'd had to really teach it to every single individual elephant in the entire herd. We had to do a few things with some of the sub-matriarchs, but yes, our hope is that not only have they learned the new route, but they've also learned that in the new route that the older elephants have not encountered any gunfire, have not had any of their family members killed by poachers. And so hopefully they will recognize that this new route was a safe route. The new route still got them where they were going. And a lot of the younger animals will, of course, that will be the only route that they know, but there's a lot of unknowns about it. This is not something that has ever been done before, which is actually true of most of the conservation projects I work on. Everyone is unique. Every time it's a different species of animal, and we're trying to do something a little different or a little unheard of. But it's one of those really interesting puzzles that I enjoy working on to say, okay, how do we take these techniques that we've used, but now I cannot necessarily impact the animal's environment in too big of a way. And I need to find ways of teaching them to do some new behavior. And how do we do that in a totally wild setting? They're challenges, they're like mental puzzles that I have to work out, but they've been, it's been very rewarding when we've seen them succeed. And now I've been doing this kind of conservation work for almost 30 years. And so it's becoming a little bit more recognized and a little bit more common, but it's still not a normal thing. It's still, we have to reinvent the wheel every time we suggest a conservation type training project, because it's just not something that most conservation biologists have ever heard of before.
So what initially drew you into animal training?
You know, it was very interesting when I was in high school. I grew up on a ranch in southern New Mexico. So I had been around horses and cattle and dogs my entire life. But interestingly enough, I did not think that I would be going down an animal related career. But when I was in high school, I had an opportunity to volunteer at a guide dog school. And during that time, I just became fascinated with the idea of training. And I think the thing that really drew me in was the fact that we were teaching animals to help people in need. And I felt like, wow, what a cool job, you know, playing with animals all day long, but doing it for this noble purpose. And then after a year of volunteering, they actually hired me as a youth handler. And that meant I got to groom the dogs and work with the dogs. And by my senior year in high school, I was actually a handler. And I got to work with the dogs, and the professional trainers would tell me how to hold the leash and when to do what, and I would follow their instructions. And I think that not only was I drawn into the idea of training dogs for this wonderful goal of helping people in need, but I was also fascinated. I will tell you that the thing that really blew my mind as a trainer was seeing what we refer to as intelligent disobedience. You teach these dogs that they're supposed to follow their handler's instructions 95% of the time, but there are 5% of the time when they're being asked to do something that would put them, their handler, in danger, and the dog has to recognize that situation and refuse to listen to the cue and say, nope, I'm not going to do this behavior, even though you're telling me to do it. And I think the one that fascinated me most was watching dogs recognize low-hanging obstructions like a tree branch or a clothesline or a sign that hung down low. And the reason that I think that I was fascinated by that is because the dog can quite easily walk underneath it. There is no risk to the dog. So the dog has to understand that its guardian, its handler cannot walk under that low-hanging sign or that low-hanging clothesline, and they have to refuse to move forward and get the handler to go a different route. I was just fascinated by the what I perceived at the time. I was a high school kid, so I hadn't really completely understood it, but I was thinking, wow, this is such an intelligent thing that the dogs are figuring out how to do. And I was kind of fascinated by that, and I wanted to understand more about how do you teach this and how do you go about doing that. And so when I went into college, I went in with the idea that I was going to be a guide dog trainer, and that was my goal, that was my mission. I just had 3 years of exposure to it while I was in school, and I was destined, I felt, to be a guide dog trainer. That's not exactly what ended up happening, though. As I was going through college, I had an opportunity to work at a marine life park where they trained dolphins and sea lions and things like that. And I got a job there in the education department helping to teach classes about these animals. And I found that all the stuff that I had learned about dog training is exactly what they were doing with the dolphins and the sea lions. And I hadn't anticipated going into the zoological field. I still had in my head I was going to be a guide dog trainer. But after my first summer working at this facility, the director of the marine mammal training program asked me if I was interested in an entry-level position. And I had never occurred to me to go into training some other type of animal, but I ended up getting that job and fell in love with that. And that was where I was really introduced to the world of positive reinforcement. And what I mean by that is the guide dog school that I had worked at used positive reinforcement, but they didn't use it exclusively. They at that time, this was in the early 70s, so this was 50 plus years ago. At that time, guide dogs were.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace.
Last year, I went through many different life changes. I needed to take a pause and examine how I was feeling in the inside to better show up for the ones who need me to be my best version of myself.
When you're navigating life's changes, Talkspace can help. Talkspace is the number one rated online therapy, bringing you professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatry providers that you can access anytime, anywhere.
Living a busy life, navigating a long-distance relationship, becoming a first-step father, Talkspace made all of those journeys possible. I could speak with my therapist in the office. I could speak with my therapist in the comfort of my home. I was never alone.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay, no insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Still trained using a few aversive tools, mainly to maintain obedience and to punish a dog if they got off track. And so I had not yet been exposed to a world where positive reinforcement was really the only tool being used until I started working with marine mammals. And that just fascinated me even more, and I got drawn into that world, and sort of became my career, for the longest time. I didn't come full circle to working with dogs until much later in my career when I started being a consultant, and interestingly enough, was called in by several guide dog organizations to help them transition to the use of positive reinforcement. And it was sort of a full circle moment for me. 30 years later, I here I was helping a guide dog organization improve their training methods, move the needle to work with positive reinforcement only. And that was where I had got my start, but it wasn't an entirely positive reinforcement-based method when I first started. Sorry, my answers sometimes go on it forever.
Please do. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. So when you were working with marine mammals, what's one story or one experience that still sticks with you to this day that you still think of?
You know, it's interesting, there's lots of them, and it isn't actually a marine mammal story. It happens to be an Aldabra tortoise story. But when I was working with the marine mammals, we were in a facility that had birds of prey and had macaws and cockatoos, and we had reptiles and trained a lot of different species. And I remember I was working with this big tortoise. Aldabra tortoises are big giant tortoises and we had trained this animal, and this animal had developed a bad habit of biting pieces of wood that were in his enclosure, and we needed to find a way to take care of that. And I remember we trained an alternative behavior and taught him this alternative task to do. But it was when I was doing that with that tortoise that the connection between what I had been doing with exotic animals and dog training suddenly hit me in the face, and I realized, oh my goodness, dogs can be trained using positive reinforcement as well. Because until that time, and I know that for most experienced trainers, this seems like a no-brainer, but as a young trainer who got started in the guide dog world, I had learned about training dogs and that positive reinforcement, of course, was used to train certain behaviors, but punishment was necessary from time to time to keep the dogs on task. When I moved to the marine mammal training world and the exotic animal training world, we never used aversive tools. We always focused on positive reinforcement. And it bizarrely never occurred to me that that would work with all animals. At that particular juncture, I had mistakenly believed that, well, with domestic animals, you have to use punishment. And with exotic animals, you can use positive reinforcement only. And it was only when I was working with that Aldabra tortoise that I realized, oh my goodness, I'm fixing a behavior without punishing. I'm finding an alternative behavior instead. And at that time, I had probably been working with exotic animals for 2.5 years. And I still would go home and work with my dog using primarily positive reinforcement, but I would still, if he did something incorrect, I would yell no or use a leash correction of some kind, because that was my belief that that was what had to be done, because that's what I had learned when I was in high school. And that Aldabra tortoise incident made me go home and rethink this whole thing. And at that point, I had never met a positive reinforcement dog trainer. You know, it's much more common today. It wasn't as common back then. And I started thinking, why wasn't I aware that you could train dogs using positive reinforcement as well? And I remember at the time, internet searches weren't common. It was not something that the internet was not a thing back then. And I remember calling around to several different people that I had known in the guide dog community and a few other places and asking about positive reinforcement only training with dogs. And most of the people that I talked to were very skeptical about it, but they pointed me in the direction of Karen Pryor and some of the stuff that she had done. And I started reading Glads Before the Wind, which was a great book for me to read, because Karen Pryor got her start working with dolphins in Hawaii. And now she was working with dogs. And I began to see some of these connections of how positive reinforcement worked. And so for me, that Aldabra tortoise incident just sort of knocked me on my back and made me rethink everything I had learned about training, because I had up until that point still believed that punishment was necessary, that punishment was the only way that you could correct certain unwanted behaviors in dogs. But I realized from the 2.5 years in working in exotic animals that we were correcting unwanted behavior all the time, and we weren't using punishing tools. And I just somehow didn't make that connection that it was the same across all species. And today I'm embarrassed when I think about that, but I realize you only know what you know. And you know, you're only, you're until you've been exposed to something and shown something, I didn't make the connection that what I had been doing with dolphins and sea lions and birds of prey and tortoises and other animals worked exactly the same way with dogs. It just, I had not made that connection. So for me, that was this big light bulb aha moment that sort of changed the trajectory of my career and really made me want to become a better trainer. I hadn't been schooled in the science of training at that point, other than just basic stuff. So it was later in my career that I began approaching the science and learning about the science. But it was that tortoise incident that somehow, I don't know why the light bulb went off at that moment, but it did. It changed everything about the way I think about training, and made me look at animal behavior in a whole new light.
And what you just said there is what I've been trying to stress home, you know, with my podcast series, is like, it takes time for you to, for early career veterinarians, it takes time to get there. Just like when you were early on in your, your behavior training, it just takes time. You need exposure and you need experience. I'm sure you had a lot of frustration, but you still needed to just keep pushing forward because you learn and learn and learn, and you're still learning today.
Absolutely. I think the more experience I gain, the less I realize I know. You know, I feel like it the amount of new information and new places to learn keeps growing. And so it's rather than feeling like my cup of learning is full, as I gain experience, it feels like it's being emptied because I realize there's these gaps in my knowledge. But sometimes as a young person in the animal field, you only know what you know, and you're only exposed to certain things in certain times. And so it's those doses of realization hit you at different times that, oh my goodness, I didn't understand this. I didn't know this. I hadn't been aware of that. And you keep finding those new things. And so, yes, I'm on a constant learning journey, and I feel like it's the gap in my learning feels like it grows bigger instead of grows shorter the more experience I gain. So,
well, we also don't remember as much as we get older too. So that, you got to throw that. So what were some of the common core values you help guide you through your career?
I think one of the things that I really was introduced to with exotic animals early on was the importance of the animal's needs come first. And it really shaped my philosophy about animal care. Even today, as I consult with police dogs and guide dogs and service dogs and consult in zoos and aquariums, oftentimes when people think about why people train, the reasons that people think of that they train are often not what I consider to be the primary reasons for training. In other words, we think of training, we want to train our dog to be a guide dog. We want to train this dog to detect bombs. We want to train these animals to do specific tasks. What I learned in the zoological world was that that's a secondary reason for training. For me, when I look at training, I look at it from the viewpoint of the primary reasons we train are to help and benefit the individual animal in front of us. And so those include things like physical exercise, mental stimulation, cooperative behaviors that help us with veterinary care, etc. And ultimately, those things go directly to animal welfare. And And often, even today, when I consult, like I'll consult with I recently consulted with a police department. They were explosive detection dogs, and I was explaining my philosophy of training, and I explained the primary reasons being exercise and mental stimulation and cooperative care. And I got to the fact that I said secondary reasons for training are things like work. And the police sergeant in charge of the program said, "Sorry, Ken, we got to take a break. You cannot tell my officers that work is secondary." And I said, "Well, it is. If you really want to succeed at training, you have to put the animal's needs first." And he is saying, "No, that's not these officers are here to teach the dogs to detect explosives. That's the primary reason for training." And I said, "Well, then maybe you need to get a different consultant." And he goes, No, we want you to be here." And I said, "Well, why do you want me to be here?" And he says, "Well, Homeland Security told us that when you started working with their program improved immensely." And I looked at him and I shrugged my shoulders and I said, "Yeah, exactly." And he said, "You mean that Homeland Security follows this philosophy?" And I said, "At least they do when I'm there." And he goes, "But I don't understand how that's going to make your dog better at finding explosives." And I said, "Well, I can't give you a scientific answer for that, but I can tell you this. I believe that when you take care of the animal's needs, when you put their needs first, they are happier, healthier animals. And dogs love to use their nose. They love to play games. They love to do things. And so when they are happy and healthy, training becomes a fun exercise that they want to participate in. And what you'll see is their work, the success of their work, the statistics of the data that we've collected on the work that they're doing, it improves. They get better at it because they're enjoying it so much and they want to do the task. And so putting the animal's needs first actually helps you get better results in the tasks that you're looking for. And so for me, my biggest core value is always focusing on the animal's well-being, always focusing on animal welfare, always guiding the trainers toward that idea of making sure the animal's needs are always being met. Because I think as a young trainer, you get in your mindset, I have to train the dog to do this particular task. I have to be goal-oriented and I have to show that I can produce results by having my dog do these 35 necessary behaviors. And you're so focused on accomplishing those goals, you lose sight of the fact that your primary goal is to make sure that animal is healthy and their welfare is being met. And if you do that, you're going to accomplish the other things pretty easily. You still have to understand training. I mean, animals aren't going to magically learn it, but you have to put the animal's needs before everything else. And it's surprising to most people how that aids you in getting your ultimate goals accomplished.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So then let's take that philosophy. And what kind of unique insights can you give to veterinarians about how to incorporate those ideas to reduce animal stress and improve cooperation during exams, especially when they come in, they're stressed, their owner's stressed, they're anxious, their owner's anxious, they feed off each other.
Yes, they absolutely do. I think for me, it's an interesting question because I've often found that the best animal care programs are often ones in which the veterinarians and the trainers are actually working hand in hand in a very cooperative way. But unfortunately, in a lot of organizations, I often don't see that. I often have to remind the veterinarians and the trainers that they're on the same side. They both care about the animal's welfare. They both care about the animal's well-being. But oftentimes, my experience has been that veterinarians, unless they've been exposed to training in a big way, they often don't recognize the value of training. I've often seen veterinarians, and it's same true of trainers, that think about training as this task-oriented goal, and so consequently, they don't think about the fact that training can help you teach animals to cooperate in their own care. And the benefit of that is the reduction in stress and in the reduction in anxiety that comes with visiting the veterinarian. And I think that if more veterinarians recognize the value of training, if more trainers recognize the value that the veterinarian brings, if there was a more of a mutual respect between trainers and veterinarians, I think there would be this much better cooperative effort, which is what I think all of us strive for, but for whatever reason, there are obstacles that stand in our way. And I think if veterinarians could build relationships with some good positive reinforcement trainers, they could begin to see how so many vet care procedures could be made so much easier because the dogs can be trained to participate in things like blood sampling and nail trimming and other things that don't have to be stressful experiences for dogs if you take the time to train it. But I just think that that's not something that is in most people's radar. They're not aware of that or not thinking about the kinds of veterinary procedures and care procedures that you can actually teach your dog to participate in and turn it into a game that they look forward to so that that procedure doesn't become stressful.
Yeah, I mean, that you're talking about soft skills, which, you know, I make the argument that soft skills are completely avoided in the education. We do not get much behavior training when we're going through school. It's something you kind of learn on the fly. And I 1,000% agree with you, because I made sure I knew of two or three very good dog trainers that could help me. Now, there is one thing I'd love to get your opinion on, because it almost is a liability on our standpoint. If you have a dog who becomes aggressive towards kids or becomes aggressive in the household, what recommendations can you give to a veterinarian? Because if we say we don't address it, it becomes our problem eventually if something happens. That's one of the hardest conversations you'll ever have to have with an owner other than euthanasia. So any advice would be very much appreciated.
Aggression is a big concern, and it's one that understandably people are worried about, because if your dog is aggressive, then your dog's not welcome in certain communities. You can't go places with your dog. It becomes a danger for your own kids, for your own family. I mean, there's just all sorts of reasons why aggression becomes a serious concern. And before I answer that question, I think I would go back and say, I believe that one of the biggest stumbling blocks as people go to shelters and adopt dogs or go and get dogs, people want dogs or cats in their life. They love the idea of having a pet. I understand that. I've always had dogs myself. When people decide to become a dog's guardian, they always think about, I'm going to need a veterinarian. I'm going to need to find good food. Those two things are always uppermost in their head. But for some reason, the idea of training is not something that they think about unless they get getting a brand new puppy, or unless they're having a problem like aggression, or unless they want to compete in some kind of sport like agility. Then they think about getting a trainer. And I think that's a mistake. I always think about professional animal care, and I think about what I call the cornerstones of good animal care. And to me, the cornerstones are having a good veterinary program or a health program, having a good nutrition program, having a good behavior management program, having the right environment, having the right social structure. All of those things form the foundation of a good professional animal care program. But for whatever reason, training is often overlooked, are only thought of as important if they suddenly have a behavioral problem. They don't begin the journey by thinking about training. And when I work with people who are thinking about in doing a training program, and they'll say, you know, I just don't have the time to invest in training. I haven't really thought about training in the last 6 weeks. I always joke with them. I say, you know, that's like telling me I haven't thought about food for my animals. I haven't fed them in 6 weeks. Nobody would ever go 6 weeks without feeding their animal, but they will go months without training, without thinking about the behavior concerns of that animal. I believe the big problem we have and the reason animals develop aggression problems and other unwanted problems is because they start living in a home without those owners thinking about behavior and training as being a critical component to having a pet. You know, I feel that we keep missing the boat. Yes, they should have a vet. Yes, they should find the right food, but they should also be thinking about training. They should be thinking about the environment that that animal's going to live in, and they should be thinking about understanding and how to read an animal's body language. So often aggression develops because we don't recognize the things that we should be looking for. We don't recognize the signs of nervousness, discomfort, fear, until they become big. Most animals really exhibit lots of telltale signs that they're not comfortable, and they keep escalating those signals until they get to the point that they can't find relief, and finally it pops out of them in an aggressive form. But there were all these signs far earlier that if you knew how to read those signs, you could have staved off the aggression. You could have modified the plan so that they didn't become aggressive because you recognized that they were uncomfortable, but they kept escalating those signs until eventually the only way they could get you to do something was to growl, to bite, to lunge, to become aggressive. And then that's a learned behavior, so you have to work extra hard to get rid of it. So for me, if I had a magic wand, I would say nobody should adopt a dog unless they recognize the importance of training and they understand how to read their dog's body language, because that's an important part of communication. Just like I feel like they shouldn't adopt a dog unless they have access to a veterinarian, they shouldn't adopt a dog if they don't have good food. Training is such a big part of it. And so for me, I wish we could solve the problem by starting with the information that pet guardians are given from the day they go in and say they want to adopt a dog. That's where the problem starts from, is just subtle things that they don't recognize in reading an animal's body language. But understanding that when someone comes to you with an aggression problem, it's too late to just wave the magic wand and go back in time. So a big part of that is recognizing that, in my opinion, I would say 80 to 85% of dog aggression problems are solvable. There's just really a small percentage that are like, gosh, this is so severe, this is so ingrained in this dog, there isn't really an easy solution other than just management. But oftentimes, there is a lot that could be done to relieve and reduce the stress, the things that are causing this dog fear and anxiety, because aggression is almost always a response to discomfort, illness, nervousness, fear, anxiety about something in their life, something in their environment. And often, you know, when you start getting to the point of an animal being aggressive, that's when you need to contract or hire a good trainer who understands how to deal with aggression. You know, it's a complex and difficult situation, but there are a lot of really good trainers who understand how to begin relieving some of those stressors and begin changing that dog's behavior so that aggression isn't a permanent part of their repertoire.
Well, I'm glad you said it is a trained behavior, because that gives you, you know, makes me at least feel better about a lot of the ones that I had to have the discussion with, you know. But I've seen lines of dogs that the mom was aggressive, the dad was aggressive, and what do you know? They bred them because they were champions or they wanted, you know, puppies. And all the puppies, guess what? They're aggressive.
And yes, there's no doubt that there is certainly a genetic component to some behaviors like aggression. But so much of that behavior continues throughout their life to get reinforced, to get and it can teach the dogs to become even more aggressive. And so there's still a lot of behavioral approaches that can be taken to minimize and change the behavior that we see or call aggression. Often it's redirecting that behavior towards something else, because even genetic aggression is just a predisposition that a dog might have. And you can teach that dog to show its displeasure, show its discomfort in other ways other than growling and biting at somebody. And a lot of those things can be taught. And I still feel that the number of animals that are dealing with what I would call genetic predisposition to aggression is actually relatively few in the big scheme of things.
Well, that's like I said, very good to hear. Because that conversation is so hard, especially when they bring the dog in, and they're like, oh, this is going to be my kid's therapy dog. And there it is trying to bite everyone that's walking by. And sometimes you have to put your big boy pants on and give the owner a sense of reality, which is like, it might be a great companion, but there's not going to be much therapy other than if your son or daughter just needs someone to pet. And I still wouldn't trust that dog alone in a room with your child. So
part of it is having the knowledge and ability to assess the dogs and recognize that there are some dogs that just aren't good therapy dogs, that aren't necessarily going to be great at certain tasks.
Correct. So what's your perspective on being inclusive of different training approaches, especially when you have people with disabilities or have that dog that's just I want to say a little bit too big or too strong for them, and they might use tools other than positive reinforcement?
I take a very different and perhaps more understanding approach to working with people like that than what I think is common in the positive reinforcement world. And part of that has to do with the fact that, A, I began my career as someone who worked with animals and didn't use entirely positive reinforcement. But I've also found that in my career, the majority of people who bring me in to work with them are people who have traditionally used aversive tools. And so whether it's law enforcement or it's guide dogs or service dogs or search and rescue dogs, all of these dogs find themselves in situations where the traditional approach to training, even if they do really rely predominantly on positive reinforcement, will use aversive tools in the process and will use aversive tools when they feel they're necessary. My goal when going to work with an organization like that is to move them toward the use of positive reinforcement. But just like the training that we do with our animals, you cannot expect a dog guardian to be able to immediately go from using an aversive tool to not using an aversive tool overnight. They need to learn how to use the more positive tools. They need to find safe alternatives to the aversive tools. They have to begin to gain the confidence in using those tools. So when I go in to work with organizations that aren't entirely positive reinforcement, or when I'm working with individuals who still use aversive tools, I go in there with a good understanding of why, and I am very careful to never pass judgment or to make them feel bad for using the tools, because I understand why those tools are being used. I myself used them in the early days. And until you have an alternative, until you've learned how to teach an alternative behavior, until you've learned how to use other tools, it's the only tool that you know how to use that is going to keep you safe. And so my goal is to say to someone who invites me in is, you realize I'm a positive reinforcement trainer. So one of my goals will be to help teach you tools that can help replace the tools that you currently use. But I'm not going to expect you to just go cold turkey, stop using the old tools and start using the new tools right away, because I understand that there's some skill development there and there's some knowledge that you need to gain. And I'm happy to share that with you and show you how to do those things. And in my approach to working with those individuals, if they're here on this side and I want to get them over here, as long as I see progress in moving in the direction that I want to move them toward, I will continue to work with them. I will continue to help them because it's clear to me that they are willing to learn some new tools and they are working toward developing their skills at using those new tools. So I'm very open to working with those individuals. And one of the things that I work really hard to do when I teach positive reinforcement trainers is to help those trainers keep a more open mind. And not too often, sometimes I feel that in the positive reinforcement community, we can be such sticklers about the need to be using positive reinforcement and the humaneness of it and the welfare benefits of positive reinforcement, that we can be too quick to judge someone who isn't using those tools or who doesn't use those tools. And I've seen positive reinforcement trainers who will refuse to work with somebody who's using a choke collar or using any kind of aversive tool. And I understand their approach, but I just feel that if what we want to do is help people see the benefits of positive reinforcement, then we need to be welcoming and inviting of them to come into our circle, and we need to help them learn how to get rid of those tools and understand that they can't just go cold turkey and drop those tools right away. I'm very much a fan of approximating the owners, the guardians, to using new tools, just like we would approximate an animal to a new behavior. The use of positive reinforcement tools is not natural or instinctive for many trainers, and I understand why someone needs to use a certain tool to work with a big dog. And you could argue, well, they shouldn't have gotten such a big dog, but they already have that dog. They've grown to love that dog. And so, from my perspective, it's all right, I'm going to meet that learner where they are. I'm going to meet that guardian where they are and say, okay, let's help you use the tools you're using better and help you learn some new skills that can transition you. And once you've learned those skills and you are able to demonstrate that those skills will work for you, then you can let go of the aversive tools when you've learned the new skills. But until that time, of course, you're going to continue to use those tools because they're the thing that's keeping you safe. And until I have the ability to teach you some alternative, I cannot, should not put pressure on you to get rid of those aversive tools until I've taught you an alternative that can replace it.
I couldn't agree with you more on that. I think going in with an open mind and being able to see both sides of the story and coming to common ground is a great way just to get through life, much less veterinary medicine. I mean, because it goes back to clients too. They're like, keep it really simple. They're like, well, I'm only gonna feed my dog a raw food diet. Okay. So you can tell them the pros and cons, and you can send them the CDC and let them look about all the bad things that happen in families that feed raw food diets to their pets. But you just got to educate them, and you're not going to be able to change everybody. So you can't put your head through the wall.
I agree. I agree with you totally. I think that the idea of being open-minded, the idea of working together closely with people, finding a solution that's going to be beneficial for everyone, I think that's the approach to take. And when it comes to the use of aversive tools, I'm glad you asked me the question earlier about something that changed my life. I mean, I did not realize. I went through four years as a professional trainer, assuming, believing that punishment was still necessary. And so I can't fault someone else who has learned that or believes that. My goal is still going to be to show them, teach them another way, but ultimately it's their dog, it's their life, it's their decision. I don't want to pass judgment. I'm not walking in their shoes. All I can do is teach them some new tools, and if they find those new tools effective and want to switch, then I've done my job. I've done my job by helping them to realize the benefits of switching to a more positive tool. And that's what I want to be good at, is helping people learn to use those new tools as opposed to criticizing people who are still using aversive tools, because I understand why they're there and I understand how they came to use them.
Absolutely. So we're going to switch gears really quick, Ken. I wanted to start discussing service dogs because they're near and dear to my heart. And I know you love working with them, obviously, from your past. Let's, as a veterinarian and as a trainer, talking to each other, why is it important to look beyond breed stereotypes when selecting training service dogs? Like, what unique qualities might a variety of breeds bring to service roles?
You know, I think I'm not a big fan of being drawn to the idea of the breed stereotypes, where people feel that certain breeds are the friendly breed and other breeds are the aggressive breed. And I understand where those stereotypes come from, but I think that all dogs can learn. All dogs have flexibility in their behavior. And I think that the big aspect of being successful as a trainer is making the tasks that you would like a dog to do to be enjoyable for them. And it needs to be something, of course, that they're physically capable of doing. The value in selecting certain breeds of dogs, it's not that there's not benefits. Like, I work with avalanche dogs. Well, there are certain dogs that are more adept at working in cold, snowy environments. And so it's not that a Chihuahua couldn't be a good avalanche detection, avalanche search and rescue dog, but it isn't. They're not really the right animals for the environment. They're going to sink into the snow. There's just going to be all sorts of challenges for them. And so, understandably, you're going to pick a bigger, stronger breed that has longer coat hair. Those kinds of distinctions between why you pick certain dogs over others, that makes sense. And I think you need to be thoughtful and selective. Same way we are when we think about a guide to dog. You know, it isn't that guide dogs need to be Labrador retrievers, but guide dogs do need to be a dog that's at least about that height so that people can work with them easily and more easily. And so I think making the right selection in breed based on size and physical capability is really important. But I also think that sometimes we have biases in our head about the more friendly breed or the more aggressive breed. And realistically, I always think if we can make the job fun for them, if we can make the job something that's enjoyable for them, if we can teach them how to work in that particular environment, I think there's many, many species of dogs that often get overlooked that could be excellent at service dog work.
So let's talk about different types of organizations that do service dog training. What are your thoughts on an organization like Atlas that empowers owners to train their own service dogs?
I think that's a it's a really good model. It's not going to be the model for everyone, but so often people are really interested in training their own dog, and giving people the skills, it just means that dog isn't necessarily going to need to come back for tune-ups as much, isn't going to need to have retraining done as often, because the dog owners themselves have done the training. And I think by teaching people how to train their own service dog, what Atlas does, it empowers those individuals to understand more about their dog. I think they become more responsible dog guardians. They training also builds a stronger relationship with your dog. When you train using positive reinforcement, there's trust and joy that comes from the work. I think there's so much about that that's really beneficial. As someone who got my start working with guide dogs and have worked with guide dogs a lot in the later years, I get the model of a professional trainer's training the dog and then turning it over to a handler. There's reasons why that works for many people. But what I love about the service dog world is that there's so many different types of service dogs, and there's so many different needs that various owners might require, that learning how to train the dog for your needs yourself, I just find it to be a really powerful and unique approach. And I don't think it's right for every single dog owner, but I think the fact that Atlas focuses on that kind of model really benefits those owners in so many ways, from the standpoint of relationships, from the standpoint of being able to work through problems on their own, of the trust that is developed. All of those things, I think, are benefits that are really great in following that model.
And so I know your time is very precious, so I'm going to just ask you one last quick question. If you could change one thing about the approach of animal welfare and the training in the veterinary medicine field, what would it be?
Oh, I think I would go back to that idea of recognizing the value of training and the value of training for medical purposes. I think that I just see that value being overlooked. I would continue to really advocate for veterinarians to be more informed about behavior. I would advocate for trainers to build better relationships with veterinarians. I think that veterinarians and trainers are so valuable to the welfare of our pets. I just wish that veterinarians and trainers worked together better. And I've seen marvelous examples of it in many, many, many places. But I just sometimes think that trainers fail to recognize the value that veterinarians bring to the table, and I think veterinarians fail to recognize the value that trainers bring to the table. Not all of them, of course, but I think if I could change one thing, it would be changing that relationship and changing that, this helping everybody recognize the symbiotic nature of that relationship and how beneficial it could be if we really worked together better. And I know that there are plenty of people that do work together well. I just continue to see that being a problem, and that's the thing that I would want to see changed first and foremost.
Sounds good. Well, Ken, I'm definitely going to have you back because I want to get into the exotic animal side of stuff. I know many veterinarians, just like myself, just find that absolutely fascinating. You know, it's a field in veterinary medicine that's amazing. I remember on my board exam, it asked me the thickness of the fat at the dorsal fin on a beluga whale, and I was like, "Are you kidding me?" I just took the biggest. I think it was 9 inches. I don't know if I got it right or not. But then I had to think, "Oh yeah, if I'm working on whales, that's probably where I would give an injection." You know, but it took me forever to be like, "Why the hell do you? Why do I hell do I care?" But you know, that's just, I guess, how life is. So, Ken, thank you for everything you've done. Thank you for everything you're doing. I mean, I as veterinarians, we couldn't agree with you more. A great, great majority of us believe in the animal welfare piece, to give these animals the best life possible. And from your point of view, when it comes to training, we need to stand up as veterinarians and be like, you know, sometimes they need a break. And if things aren't going right, there's probably other avenues you need to address. And so I think that's a very important take-home point myself. So thank you, Ken. And we will talk to you again soon. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.